Cuyahoga County officials are looking at the prospect of building transit-oriented development throughout the county. Imagine apartments over street-level retail shops and sidewalks designed for walkers with access to public transit. The County Planning Commission just completed a study which focuses on rezoning some 85 square miles of land along 22 commercial corridors in Cleveland and 25 suburbs. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll talk with members of the County and Cleveland Planning Commission, along with the Greater Cleveland Regional Transit Authority, about the push towards dense, walkable, transit-oriented development. Later in the hour, we'll focus on a large investment being made by the Rocket Community Fund to support the Right to Counsel program in Cleveland, which provides tenants in the city facing eviction with free legal counsel. First, the latest national and local news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for joining us, and a happy Tuesday to all of you. The Cuyahoga County Planning Commission is completing a year-long study looking to address an issue that's been decades in the making. Urban and suburban sprawl is evident to anyone who's been across the region. Our multi-lane highways, like I-90 or 71, pour into large thoroughfares lined with parking lots, shopping centers, and industrial parkways. Sprawl might seem innocuous, but critics point to how when populations and businesses move away from an urban core, they not only take tax revenue with them, but also have detrimental impacts on the environment, even human health and safety. Along with the Cuyahoga County Planning Commission, the Greater Cleveland Regional Transit Authority, and the City of Cleveland are targeting dozens of square miles of land for potential rezoning and to encourage transit-oriented development. We'll spend the first half of the program today learning more about what transit-oriented development means and how it could affect our region. Later in the hour, we'll hear about Cleveland's Right to Counsel program, how it's faring, and new funding that will help the program move forward. But with me now to discuss new priorities around transit-oriented development are Patrick Hewitt, Planning Manager with the Cuyahoga County Planning Commission. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Mary Beth Feek is here. She is the Director of Programming and Planning at the Greater Cleveland Regional Transit Authority. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
And finally, Matt Moss also joins us. He is Manager of Strategic Initiatives at the City of Cleveland's Planning Commission. Matt, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
All right. If you'd like to join the conversation or have a question for our panel of officials and experts, call 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We are at Sound of Ideas. All right, Patrick, so let's start by talking about an example of transit-oriented development that people might be aware of already. On the east side of Cleveland, the Van Aken District in Shaker Heights is mixed use, right on a public transit line. Paint a picture of what Van Aken looks like and how you think it's demonstrative of what this transit-oriented development is.
Sure. Thank you again for having us this morning. So the Van Aken District is really a prime example of transit-oriented development, because when you think about Van Aken District, there is a transit center. It's at the end of the blue line, the Shaker Rapid. It includes multiple buildings surrounding public spaces. Those buildings are multiple stories with people living above retail, living above office. There's all of these different uses where people can take transit and walk around in a comfortable, vibrant public space where they can shop, they can live, they can work, all in one location. So when we think about Van Aken District, it's tall, it's mixed use, and it's walkable right around transit.
And Mary Beth, you said the Van Aken District didn't appear out of nowhere. It was a long time in the making.
Right. There's been at least four or five plans, and I know the City of Shaker Heights, RTA, we worked together for many years trying to get it right, because not only does it have the end of the blue line, it also has a major bus hub. So that is a center of bus and transit, and getting all those uses in a rather constricted area with traffic was very difficult to plan, but it planned. And right now, soon you'll see a new comfort station, which is for the blue line. Soon you'll see a new blue line station and a reconfigured traffic and busway that really integrates the development even more as they go into phase two and phase three.
So I understand there were studies from the city of Shaker Heights dating back to 2000 looking at the prospect of something that ultimately became the Van Aken District. I'm curious, was the Van Aken District a culmination of private and public partnership? Is it just a private development? When you have the city involvement in kind of envisioning something like this, how do they ultimately turn that into something that a business person wants to build and develop?
It is a partnership. Mm-hmm. There is private development, RMS. There is state money in the reconfiguration of Van Aken, and there's also city money as well as county money in that, and RTA money in redeveloping our train station to meet and enter into the development. So it was a long process, very complicated. A lot of study needed to go into it because you've got a lot of traffic, you've got a lot of players, and trying to say, RTA we want 5,000 feet because we have to move our trains, but you also want people living and parking and coming in a comfortable space. So it was an integrated effort. It took a lot of effort, and kudos to the city of Shaker Heights, to the county, to the developers, RTA, as well as the state for working together on that.
And shout out to Joyce Braverman, Director of Planning over at the City of Shaker Heights. The process to get from the initial plan to seeing buildings built was very time consuming, and that city put a ton of effort into getting that done. It does take all the players. It takes the public to get the regulations right, to get zoning right, to get public right-of-way improved in a manner that can support transit-oriented development, and then it takes the private sector to come in and actually build many of those buildings and bring the people, bring the jobs, bring the retail there.
So, Matt, I'm curious, are you able to give an RTA perspective on the Van Aken District since we're talking about that and the ability to catch a bus or jump on a train from there?
Well, I can certainly give a city perspective on that. I think, I don't work for the city of Shaker Heights, but I think I want to emphasize a point that Patrick and Mary Beth both made, which is the infrastructure and being able to, people start and end their transit trips as pedestrians, as people crossing or walking on the street. And I think the effort that RTA and the city put in to get that infrastructure right, it might not be the most obvious part of when you look at a TOD, especially a new transit-oriented development project. You'll see the new housing, the new retail, the new office. Sometimes the infrastructure gets missed, but that's a crucial part. That's, without that, I don't know that that project would have been as successful as it is.
And I apologize for that. I cross-referenced my RTA person with my City of Cleveland person. Okay, let's talk about the West Side. What do you think is a good example of this transit-oriented development?
Well, one of the most prominent recent examples, I would say, and this is well featured in much of the documentation and publications that the county has put out in their excellent TOD planning report, is the Intro development over on the near West Side. That's right on the corner of West 25th and Lorraine. And it's interesting from several perspectives. It exemplifies many of the details that the County Planning Commission has identified as high quality elements of high quality TOD, which are getting
transit oriented development.
That's right, transit oriented development. Getting the parking right in terms of just the amount, but also where it's located. If you go to that building, you might not realize that there's quite a bit of parking, but it's underneath the building, for example. And so that means you have much of, if not the entire ground floor of that building, is open space or retail or some other type of use. And that really helps activate the street. But another interesting point, too, is across the street, you have the historic West Side Market, which I would argue, at least, is also a transit-oriented facility. It's a transit-oriented development. It's about 100 years old now, but back then it was and still is to this day. It's very accessible both by bus and by rail.
The West Side that he just talked about is also a node for RTA. Mm-hmm. We have a Red Line station there, our train station at West 25th Street, and we have a high-density bus route network that goes through and crisscrosses that area. And in fact, with the city's help, we will soon begin engineering and designing a BRT, a bus rapid transit line, that goes from downtown through and ends about the zoo, down 25th Street, again, solidifying the transit-oriented development and the land uses. It's got the form, it's got the density, and it's got the transit, all the things we really need to create a vibrant community center that's focused on transit, giving people alternatives and a big city vibe to a smaller city. Cleveland has got one of the strongest, most robust networks of transit in the entire, well, it's in the state, but in the region. Look at our size. We've got a system built like Chicago. That's what we built our system. We've got light rail. We've got heavy rail, which is the red and blue and green lines. We've got the best BRT, the Healthline, in the world, as well as more coming. We've got the CSU line down Clifton, and we're designing the another one down 25th Street. So for transit, and it's so great to see the city and the 15-minute city and the TOD, the county and the city, and we're working on just finally saying, we've got a huge asset. Let's really build on it. That's the way that we can build our city and really create vibrancy and new development within the core.
If you'd like to ask a question or contribute a thought to this conversation, it's 216-578-0903 or 866-578-0903. Email us at soi@ideastream.org. We did get an email from Sarah from Shaker Square, who asks the hard question, has RTA ridership actually increased since the Van Aken District's inception?
Our ridership has not increased because we're still dealing with the pandemic. And the light rail line that goes to the Van Aken District has been down a lot because we've been doing a lot of fixing. But we've never seen it go down. The weekends are always really vibrant. So yes, it is. It's giving people a destination. Before, when you took the blue line, you went to Shaker Square or downtown or the end of the line. And now you've got this great, vibrant district. And it's also increased our ridership going the opposite way. So if people are coming downtown or the other way, but in the evenings going to the Van Aken District, ridership is going up.
And if I could add, one of the purposes behind our transit-oriented development zoning study was recognizing that we do have this great transit system with rail and rapid bus lines and frequent bus lines. We have to get the development right so that we can have that increase in ridership. And let me paint a picture. If you step off of a bus and you have to cross a wide, fast thoroughfare, you have thin sidewalks without any street trees, you have to walk across a massive parking lot just to get to one retail storefront in a suburban shopping center, that's going to make riding transit really difficult and not particularly enjoyable. And one of the pieces that we really wanted to focus on with this project is let's get the development right to make riding transit easier and more enjoyable so that when you step off the bus, you are right in the middle of a vibrant place where retail, shopping, maybe your house or an apartment are right there when you step off the bus or the train.
Let's put a finer point on that, Patrick, because I think what's so important about the work that the county is doing and on all of the communities that are partners in this as well is really understanding that, you know, projects like Van Aken District are excellent examples and they're excellent projects and they take years to get right and appropriately so. And I think what the county's work represents and the work we're doing in these other communities is trying to get to a point where this is how you can build by right. And that is an important concept to understand, because many of the zoning codes that exist in Cleveland and communities that RTA touches, you can't build a building or occupy a building without needing some type of what's called a zoning variance. So you need to ask essentially special permission from a city in order to build something like the Van Aken District, for example, or even something more appropriate in terms of the scale of the surrounding context. That's still oftentimes the exception, not the rule. And I think that that's an important part of this work and what we're trying to do.
Okay.
And as we try to develop smaller businesses and authentic businesses in our core, what do you mean I have to go to 47 different meetings in order to get my windows and my door this way? Mm-hmm. So it really does help small businesses and us to develop some authenticity in our districts.
So zoning seems to be a crucial part of, you know, turning something that is a blueprint into an actualized development. So tell me more about this study. The fact that it's broad in scope, 85 miles of potential area that might be developed, and how zoning plays a part into this study and the future of these developments.
Sure. So the zoning study itself covers 22 corridors that cover that touch significant portions of 26 different communities in Cuyahoga County. So we looked at the zoning along those corridors. And really, we looked at a quarter mile around bus stops and a half mile around train stations. And we asked, could you build a mixed-use walkable development? And we asked five basic questions. We asked, could something be tall? Could it be built close to the street? Could it have low parking? Could it cover most of the lot? And could it have a mix of uses? Could you have residential and retail, etc.? When we looked at that, we looked at all of the zoning codes for those communities. Just 5.5% of land along our most frequent bus corridors and train corridors is zoned in a manner that supports TOD. Just 5.5%. So the other 94.5%, you can't build that by right. You're going to need a variance. You're going to need to go to the city. You're going to need a rezoning to be able to build something like the Van Aken District.
And you're saying it's bureaucratic, it takes time, and it doesn't encourage a more efficient or kind of fast approach to rejiggering, revitalizing an area so that it might have apartments and businesses in one area.
Right. What Matt said was really important. We want to create a system where building transit-oriented development by right is allowed. Right now, it's not. Other types of development are allowed. Maybe a more traditional suburban-style shopping center, maybe a drive-through. Those might be allowed by right, but building a mixed-use development, a transit-oriented development, are not allowed. And we want to make it as easy as possible to build that.
You know, we do a lot of reporting and conversation having on the Sound of Ideas on IdeaStream in general about the fact that in the city of Cleveland, you know, there's a lot of people who really rely on public transit, don't have vehicles. I mean, is that a part of the city of Cleveland's concern and approach in this transit-oriented development to allow for jobs and an economic vitality in the same area that a lot of people are taking public transit?
Absolutely. And we've been doing our own companion work in conjunction with the great work that the county's been leading along with its partners. And in Cleveland, it's approximately a quarter of households in the city don't have access to a vehicle. They don't have a car in their household in order to drive and take trips to. 70% of households have either no car or one car available. And in fact, also one in five Clevelanders are generally, they're too young to drive. They're under the age of 16. And so we have these regulations, these rules, the rules that govern how city streets can look and when what you can do on them that say, if you don't have a car or if you can't drive, whether you're due to age or perhaps some type of disability even, that what can be built around you is not as accessible to you if you're walking, biking, or have to take transit. And so that's in a lot of ways at the centerpiece of how we're trying to flip these rules around and make sure that the city is you're able to do those types of things in the city to provide services and goods to those people, and to make that a process by which we want to encourage and say yes to, instead of the default answer being no.
Patrick, I want to talk about another specific example. In a Cleveland.com article, Steve Litt cites the example of Turneytown in Garfield Heights as a potential example of this older sprawl-type planning and development that could eventually be reworked and redesigned. Turneytown is this classic shopping center with the parking lot right off the street with a row of stores in the back. How does the Planning Commission view these types of land and property, and how might they become redeveloped?
Sure. So this is a really good example because it is a traditional suburban shopping center that we see all over the region and along many of the corridors that we're talking about. The Turneytown Shopping Center includes things like a Dave's Market. It includes other retail stores. When we have been working with the city of Garfield Heights, we brought to them an image of what that shopping center might look like in the future and showcased something that included incorporating a grid pattern of streets so that there's easier access to walk around, adding landscaping, creating developable sites where new mixed-use buildings could be built there. And one of the things that was really helpful was to be able to say, this shopping center is about 14 acres. The Van Aken District's original site was only 6.5 acres. So while Van Aken which is a great local example, feels like a really large site compared to many of these shopping centers that we see around the region. These are even bigger than the Van Aken District. So these are great examples of places that could be redeveloped to incorporate more housing, different types of housing that can incorporate retail, that incorporate jobs, so that it's not just a retail shopping center, but it's a place that people can go, have, incorporate public space, go hang out, shop, live, work, etc.
Mary Beth, I've got to say, we're getting a lot of interest in the fact that you are here with Greater Cleveland RTA through tweets, emails, and phone calls about RTA lines and lines that are not running. I have to give some of the listeners an opportunity to ask their questions. Chris from Ohio City, welcome to The Sound of Ideas. Thanks for calling in, and go ahead.
Hi, thanks. I called in because of Mary Beth's comment claiming that the Health Line is the best bus rapid transit in the world. I just don't believe that. That line runs every 15 minutes.
Up, did we lose Chris? We might have lost Chris. All right. Chris has been lost. So he wanted to discuss why certain RTA services have been cut. But
I didn't hear the Health Line that it's only 15 minutes. We are looking, we did our next gen right as COVID started. That was our first revamp of the bus system. And it was generated trying to get people to jobs. Over time, we have decreased the amount of buses, and the frequency has decreased on the Health Line. But we're looking to put it back. When I say it's one of the best of the world, it's because of the built environment. It's median running. It's got the signalization. It's got stations. It's a solid system. It's not on the curb that every, during the peak hours only in that peak direction. It's a solid system. We are working to tweak it. It just had its 10-year anniversary. It's going on 15 years now. We're actually looking at it, if it could be more efficient as it turns from 105th to East Cleveland and Hayden. But we understand it is one of the premier systems of BRT in the country, and we're really looking to make it better. So I'm glad to hear we're trying to get the frequency increased. It's difficult to keep the headways and the travel time because there's a lot of construction in downtown Cleveland as well as along the line. But we're doing the best we can and look for it to improve in the next few years.
So where do we take this study going forward? You need to complete it. And then what are the next steps?
So the zoning study itself includes four parts. We're on the fourth part, and that is thinking about how we can support financing future developments along transit lines. Where we ended the study was the zoning part of the study was understanding that there is a mismatch between what we would like to see built, the transit-oriented development, and the fact that zoning won't allow it. While that's the end of the study, that means we need to go update some zoning. So we are going to be putting together at the County Planning Commission a model zoning code, a model zoning overlay that communities can adopt. We don't have control over local zoning. That's up to local communities. But we are great partners with local communities to help them adopt some of these regulations that can allow TOD. We're not doing this alone at the County Planning Commission. We can help frame the conversation, but places like the City of Cleveland have already been making the changes necessary to support this type of development. We're going to keep supporting them. We're going to help where we can as well.
And I know the City of Cleveland has been promoting adopting its 15-minute city plan. The 15-minute city is what it's called, right? Can you kind of elaborate on how this plays into to the notion of getting around within that time?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the important concept for your listeners to understand is that, simply put, it just means we want to look at the ways in which the tools that we have at local government, especially in the Planning Commission, to see how can we make it easier for people to get to whatever they might need to or want to in their day-to-day lives, ideally within 15 minutes or less. And that includes walking, riding a bike, taking a bus or a train, and also driving. And the reality is that if you own a car and you can drive, you are essentially within 15 minutes of just about anything you might want or need for the most part. And so that's why we're focused on these other modes, because we want to create options and we want to provide flexibility. And we understand that not everyone can drive, not everyone has access to a car. And so that's why those other modes are important. And so it really comes down to, I think we're at a starting point in this region in the sense that these types of things, we're talking about taking them from being illegal to legal.
Sure.
And I think that's a really important point, because in a lot of ways, the types of projects that and even just small businesses that people know and love and like to walk to or bike to or even drive to are in some ways they exist or open in spite of the rules in place. And that's something we're trying to really rectify. And so at the City of Cleveland, for example, we've done two things that we're working on that really impact this. The first one is back in August, our city council approved what we call our transportation demand management program. It's a big fancy term that essentially means near our high frequency bus and rail corridors, so many of the major roads, Detroit, Lorain, Superior, that kind of thing, and also the train stations, projects won't be required to provide off-street parking of any kind. They'll be able to, owners and businesses will be able to decide how much parking they need to provide. There won't be a city number that they'll have to meet, but what they will have to do, depending upon the size of the project, is provide things like transit passes or enhance the transit waiting environment. So the bus stop that might be near their building, or provide daycare on site, for example. Those are options that they'll be able to pick from in order to make it easier to, again, do those things, to walk, bike, and take transit. And then the other major initiative we have, which really pairs well with the county work in terms of writing a model code, is the city's working on a form-based code pilot, which is essentially almost a wholesale rewrite of the city's zoning code to prioritize how buildings look and how they address the street, rather than and putting less of an emphasis on the types of uses that are allowed in those buildings, because uses change over time.
We got an email from a listener that said, please include small farms and gardens that grow vegetables, fruits, and free-ranging chickens for egg production in all new urban, suburban, and neighborhood plans. We are running out of time, but Mary Beth, I liked what you were talking about before we started the show, about the fact that, you know, there are already developments that can be repurposed and revitalized as a part of this. You talked about Shaker Square, but I'm sure, you know, all this kind of urban or suburban sprawl that we're talking about, to use the old structures and to develop them, will be a part of this. And I think it's good environmental practice, too, to not just demolish, but to, you know, kind of rebuild with what we have.
Correct. I mean, we talked about Shaker Square because I think that in the history, it was the second retail shopping district, and it's built around transit. It's built on a vibrancy of density and density of units around, you know, going from the very high apartments to smaller and the houses. That can be repurposed, and I know there's a lot of work right now to reimagine Shaker Square. Downtown Cleveland, Public Square, Lakewood, Bedford, there's lots of places that have unique, dense areas that are served and always have been served by transit. Before RTA was formed in the early 70s, North Olmsted, Maple Heights, Garfield Heights, a lot of other cities all had their own transit systems, and we just incorporated them all. But now that we're one, creating those nodes is easy. I mean, they're already there. Let's just, with the zoning, the land from the 15-minute city, let's work together to create a better, vibrant node throughout the county. That's our service area. We want to connect the community. We want to get people to jobs, work, and employment, and also to fun events. What we're finding after the pandemic is people are only working, going to a job. They're working from home, but they want to go other places. They want to go to the Cavs, the Indy, the Guardians, and the theater, and just to home days in their community. And we want to take them there.
Mary Beth Feek from the Greater Cleveland RTA, Patrick Hewitt from Cuyahoga County, and Matt Moss from the City of Cleveland. I thank all of you for joining me this morning for this conversation.
Thanks a lot.
So much.
Thank you.
Time now for a quick break, but when we return, we'll discuss a new partnership that aims to help people facing evictions in Cleveland and Northeast Ohio. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. 5 years ago, Cleveland became the fourth city in the country to pass right to counsel legislation. That means eligible low-income families would have a guaranteed right to legal representation when facing eviction. Prior to right to counsel launching in July of 2020, court data found that only 1-2% of all tenants were represented by an attorney in court. But an analysis found last year, almost 80% of all eligible households facing eviction were represented by legal aid. Today, the Rocket Community Fund, which is the nonprofit charitable arm of Rocket Mortgage and the Legal Aid Society of Cleveland, has announced a $1.25 million investment to create the Cleveland Eviction Defense Fund that will continue to support the right to counsel work. Joining me in studio to discuss this investment and the effort to combat housing instability in Cleveland are Colleen Cotter, Executive Director of Legal Aid Society of Cleveland. Colleen, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And we have Laura Graneman, Executive Director of Rocket Community Fund. Thanks for making the trip from Detroit, I see.
Yes, thank you for having me. We're very excited to be here.
All right, great. If you'd like to join the conversation, have a thought or a question, you can call us at 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or you can tweet us. We are at Sound of Ideas. So, Colleen, I'm going to start with you. Let's go back to the beginning of right to counsel in Cleveland. It's a relatively new concept for cities. The idea behind the legislation is that people face eviction in civil court where they are not guaranteed representation if they can't afford it like they do in criminal court. So can you kind of elaborate on the concept for us?
Absolutely. As you indicated, when you're charged with a crime, you have a constitutional right to an attorney, which makes sense. If the government is trying to put you in jail, you should have a lawyer to represent your interests. We don't have a similar constitutional right in civil cases where very important things are at risk, like housing. So imagine you are a tenant, you are served with an eviction notice, and you don't even know what to do. You have children in your house, you have to get to work, you have to get your kids to school, and you have to find a new house because the idea of going to court without a lawyer is virtually impossible, and you're losing your home. So in 2019, the City of Cleveland leadership in City Council and the administration had the vision to create a right to counsel, knowing that in evictions, again, something so important is at risk, and that to stabilize our community, to create strong neighborhoods, we need strong neighbors who are solid and know that they can stay in their home. So the right to counsel passed. As you indicated, we were the fourth city in the country to establish a right to counsel. And the data has shown that we are a leader in implementation. We have the Legal Aid Society of Cleveland is charged with providing that legal assistance to families with low income who have children in the household. About a third of tenants faced with eviction qualify for the right, and we're representing 80% of those tenants now to great success.
And what are the other cities that are implementing this?
So I think now there are about 17 cities, counties, and states that have established a right to counsel. New York City was the first one to implement. We were the second one to start implementation. And we started implementation right at the heart of the pandemic in July of 2020. So I think the fact that we had created the right to counsel, and the city did not do this as a response to the pandemic. It was before the pandemic, but having the right to counsel during the pandemic
Sure.
kept people safe and in their homes.
And Laura, why did Rocket Community Fund want to partner with Legal Aid to create this legal fund, and what will the money go towards?
Well, it's funny you ask the other cities that have implemented because, as you mentioned, I'm from Detroit. Rocket is headquartered in the city of Detroit, and we followed Cleveland's lead a couple of years ago and implemented as well a right to counsel in Detroit. And so we have some direct experience implementing and funding from the Rocket Community Fund and the Gilbert Family Foundation right to counsel. Council in Detroit. And so we knew the power of right to counsel. It certainly helps people stay in their homes. It provides, I think the most fundamental thing is it provides a support system during a really stressful time. No matter what the situation is, you can always use that support system, right? And too often, I think people assume that because a renter is being evicted, they must just not be paying their rent. But that's actually not accurate. What we see is quite a variety of situations. And in particular, in cities like Detroit and Cleveland, a lot of times what's happening are the landlords are actually not keeping up with their end of the bargain. A lot of times there's home repair issues or other challenges in the house that the tenant is trying to navigate and deal with. And so it's really important to provide an additional support to the tenant when the odds are just often not in their favor. So that's been really critical to us. And then also we have a significant presence here in Cleveland. And one of the investments that we made a couple of years ago was in some door-to-door outreach where we reached out to 10,000 plus families in Cleveland, asking for more information and trying to connect them with resources about their housing stability experience. And a few of the questions were related to a renter's experience specifically. And what we found was about 20% of renters through that door-to-door outreach effort said that they were struggling to pay their rent. And so we saw this as a significant vulnerability and right to counsel as an important investment.
So, Colleen, you've kind of given us some parameters of who might be facing eviction and needs that free legal help. Give us again kind of exactly who is eligible for the right to counsel help? So, and who often do you find needing it?
Yeah, so the right to counsel applies to, in the city of Cleveland, for families who are at 100% of the federal poverty guidelines and below, and where there's a child in the household. There are a lot of other tenants who need rental assistance or need assistance in an eviction, and legal aid does handle a lot of evictions outside of right to counsel, but there's not a guarantee of that right. That's where it applies. And what we find, as Laura said, we find certainly people who had an emergency, weren't able to pay rent last month. And we also find people who are faced with conditions issues of the home. We had one client recently who looked at an apartment. It looked great, moved in, and found that it had been stripped. All the cabinets in the kitchen, the appliances, everything was gone. She talked to the landlord. They said, yeah, go ahead and take care of it, and I'll reimburse you. She took care of it, was not reimbursed, continued to have issues with the habitability of the home, continued to pay contractors because she was trying to keep her family safe and healthy.
Sure.
Then, because she was paying all of this, she couldn't pay her rent, and he filed for eviction. So she came to us. Fortunately, when folks are served with an eviction notice, the court gives them notice. You might be eligible for a lawyer from Legal Aid because of right to counsel. Our partner at United Way does a lot of outreach to tell the community, you have a right. So she came to us. We were able to, and she no longer wanted to stay in this place, which was pretty much a nightmare. But we were able to get the eviction dismissed so it was not on her record, because having an eviction on your record can be a huge barrier to future housing and even employment, credit issues. So we got that off of her record. We got her enough time to move to a new place, and we got her reimbursed for the money that she had put out to pay for the contractors that really the landlord should have done all along. So without the right to counsel, this is somebody who would have been stuck with an eviction on her record, and she would have been out thousands of dollars that she paid to the contractors, and she probably would have been homeless with her children while she was searching for a new place. All of that, and as Laura said, the support, instead of approaching that situation with the fear of the unknown, because she's not trained to go into court and understand those systems, she had one of our very highly skilled lawyers by her side enforcing her rights.
We had a reference of a 2019 Case Western Reserve University study that found that more than 75% of Cleveland eviction filings, the head of household was a woman, was Black, And in 60% of cases, there were children under 18. So we're talking about working moms, single moms, with a household with children, having to navigate a court system and, you know, an eviction by themselves. It's interesting. It seems that those who can least afford an attorney are the ones who are facing, you know, a really kind of unstable situation of being threatened to not have a home.
That's absolutely right. The racial impact of evictions in our community is real. As you said, Black women, especially Black women with children, are those who are faced with eviction most often. And so having a system that doesn't provide a lawyer is clearly injustice. So Right to Counsel and Raqqa Community Fund support brings justice to the community, and that those tenants can use their voice and participate in the system to their good.
So my understanding, Laura, is that the Raqqa Community Fund's, would you call it a grant?
Yes.
Grant
yep.
money is sustaining this program for 5 years. So tell me more about the interest of doing this in kind of a long-term capacity.
Yeah, well, I think one of the biggest opportunities for philanthropic funders to be able to support is a long-term commitment, because too often we see our nonprofit partners, you know, doing great work and they're getting year-to-year funding, and that's fantastic. And we you know, that's important. But if you can make a long-term commitment, I think it gives more certainty to both the partner and ultimately to the clients that they're serving to be able to do this work in the long run and really think bigger about how to scale, how to operate, you know, with larger efficiencies. And so that's what we really aimed to do. This is a 5-year commitment. And, you know, we are in it for the long haul. We believe in this mission and we're excited to be a partner.
And having that long-term commitment is absolutely critical for a program like this, for so much of our work. But this has been, from the beginning, a public-private partnership with funds from the City of Cleveland, from Cuyahoga County, and from philanthropic partners like Rocket. And only because of that partnership have we been able to launch this. Part of our commitment was to say to all of those funders, we're going to make sure that there is a really solid evaluation so that we can know, is this indeed effective? Is this a good investment in our community? And our evaluator has concluded that the return on investment is about $3 to every dollar that goes into the Right to Counsel program. So that's money's return to the community. So we have shown, because of the incredible support from the community, that not only do we prevent evictions, in 86% of the cases that we've handled, the client is either able to stay in their house or able to have enough time and support to move to another housing situation and not left with that period of homelessness and doubling up. So 86% of the time, and these are cases, as Laura said, that so often people just assume, oh, the tenant can't do anything, it's non-payment, there's nothing to be done. It's not true. There is something to be done, and we've shown it. And it's because of this leap of faith of organizations like Rocket that we've been able to give this back to the community and show. But now we also, the really important part of Rocket's investment is a lot of the funding that we've had for Right to Counsel has come because of COVID funding. And that's been fantastic. And the city and county have been able to provide that because of COVID funding. But we all know that the COVID funding will be going away. And so together, we need to figure out, how do we sustain this long term? Because without the money behind it, the right is just on a piece of paper.
I just want to double down on what Colleen just said. I think a lot of people don't realize the savings and return that investments like this can have. Of course, not for philanthropic partners, but for the community itself. There's so many downstream effects of eviction, you know, things like homelessness, which, of course, we have a whole homelessness service provider system, right? Shelter system, emergency response.
Sure.
There's other downstream effects like education disruptions, right? Our school systems are really affected when students move from one school to another. So I think recognizing that investments like this public and private investments like this can really have strong impacts, not just on the individuals that are supported, but ultimately ripple effects on the entire community.
And one can only imagine, you know, the stress that it induces for the parent or the person who is facing eviction, and how that might affect their ability to work and care for the children. So there's even, an emotional component that might not be addressed. We had an email from Pat who says this conversation kind of leads to the thought that there is an obscene lack of affordable housing and rental housing in Northeast Ohio thanks to the greed mongers of the capitalist system. Thanks, Pat, for your thought. I think the first line of that might be the most pertinent, you know, the idea that affordable housing in safe structures be available to people in Cleveland and all of Northeast Ohio. I'm curious, is the fact that maybe providing legal aid to these people facing eviction, does it have a deterrence factor for potential bad actors who are landlords?
Yeah, our theory was at the beginning that we would achieve a few things. One, we would keep people housed, and that's the most important. Two, we would have this return on investment to the community, also very important. But the other two are longer term. We believe it changes the whole environment of evictions, that if landlords know that the tenant is going to show up with a lawyer, then it changes the calculus for them about filing. And lots of landlords are very responsible and are doing the right thing, but some landlords are not. And so to have that deterrent effect that, oh, this is actually going to be more expensive if I file for eviction, some landlords have a churn model that they just want to keep people, get people in and out, and that's their business model. So having that deterrent effect to make sure that they better think before they file, because legal aid will be there and will do a really good job at defending our clients' rights. But the other long-term impact that we believe right to counsel has is increasing the value of the housing stock and the condition of the housing stock. Because there are a lot of rights that tenants have in terms of habitability of their homes, but it's really hard to enforce those rights. And in the eviction process, there is the opportunity to bring a counterclaim to say, you know, the pipes are leaking, the roof is leaking, there isn't heat. And that's an opportunity to enforce the code and get the landlords to actually hold up their part of the bargain. But without that ability, it's really hard for tenants to do that on their own. And so this is an opportunity for those rights to be enforced also. We found that half of the cases that we've handled, there is a conditions issue. So over time, and this will be something, again, that our evaluator is looking at, over time, we believe that it will show an improved housing conditions in Cleveland, which also has an impact on lead poisoning, as we know. So there's a lot of issues here with regard to employment and education and safety and health for our community.
We have 30 seconds left for an answer, but I'm curious, what about the people who don't fall within the parameters of getting legal representation? Let's say an older individual, a person who doesn't have legal immigration status. Are there potentials to include other swaths of people facing eviction?
So legal aid does represent tenants who are not eligible for right to counsel. So I would encourage people to call legal aid. And other cities have a broader right to counsel. In Detroit, it's not just limited to 100% of poverty and where children are in the household. So perhaps in the future, Cleveland will look to expanding. And again, this only applies in the city of Cleveland. And so many of your listeners live outside of the city of Cleveland. We'd love to see it even broader.
Colleen Cotter, Executive Director with the Legal Aid Society of Cleveland, and Laura Graneman, Executive Director of the Rocket Community Fund. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Now, to get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter @SoundOfIdeas. You can follow me @JennyHamill_. Yesterday, we spent the hour discussing shifting policies and practices around tipping. We had a ton of feedback and couldn't get to all of it, so we want to include some emails. Jerry emailed, "I tip according to difficulty of task as well as level of service. Picking a donut out of a display case isn't the same as delivering drinks and dinners to a table of 10. Donna sent this thought. The server can't control all of the factors that go into the quality of service. Since the restaurant may be understaffed and the server can't give more personal attention, tip anyway. Patricia wrote us, quote, "The whole tipping culture is abusive of the people who work for wages that don't meet basic base wage laws. It's disgusting that they need to depend on tips." And we close with this thought from Lucy in Seven Hills. "When I tip, it's usually 20%, but I try to read the situation. Is the person not coming to our table because she's working the whole floor alone, overworked? Now more than ever, with low staffing everywhere, patience and empathy should be what's on the menu." Thank you so much for your thoughts. We love when you contribute. And thanks to all of our listeners for weighing in. Now, tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, we'll discuss gerrymandering in Ohio. We'll get the latest on the maps and the challenges that were in front of the Ohio Supreme Court, as well as a proposed redistricting amendment that voters could see in 2024. I'll be speaking with former Ohio Supreme Court Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor for that segment. Excited about that. And 1 week from tonight, join us for our next Sound of Ideas community tour. We'll be discussing the state of school boards at the Hudson Library and Historical Society next Tuesday, December 12th at 6:30 p.m. The event is hosted by our own Mike McIntyre and free and open to the public. You can sign up for the event by going to IdeaStream Public Media's Facebook page. If you missed any portion of the program, find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening, and we will speak with you again tomorrow.
The Sound of Ideas is produced by Rachel Rood, Lee Barr, Drew Mazias, and Jay Shaw. Chris Dudley and Samson Albel provide technical assistance. Jay Nungesser is at the controls of the Ohio Channel broadcast, and our host is Jenny Hamill. Thanks for tuning in.